abolition, abolition
today. Threw mostly black males, but also women, into jail, where they become a perfect labor force, much better than slaves. If you're a slave owner, you have to pay for, you have to keep your capital alive. If the state does it for you, it's terrific. No strikes, no disobedience, perfect labor force. A lot of the American Industrial Revolution in the late 19th, early 20th century is based on that. Actually, it pretty much lasted until the Second World War, when there was a need for what's called free labor in the war industry. After that come about two decades in which African Americans had a kind of a shot at entering the society. A black worker get a job in an auto plant. The unions were still functioning, maybe buy a small house, send his kid to college or something. By the 1970s or 80s, it's going back to criminalization of black life.
The world is a vampire. We'll be right back.
Abolition. 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 Abolition.
You just heard Noam Chomsky on prison slavery, and that was followed by the Smashing Pumpkins, Bullet with Butterfly Wings. Peace and welcome to Abolition Today, a weekly syndicated online radio program with a specific focus on modern slavery as it is practiced through the 13th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution and by for-profit prisons worldwide. We air live every Sunday at 7 p.m. Eastern, 6 Central, 5 Mountain, and 4 Pacific. Live streams and archived podcasts are available at abolitiontoday.org and on all major streaming platforms, including Amazon Music. My name is Yusuf Hassan, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Max Parthas. Peace, Max.
Peace, Yusuf. I'm here at the Paul Cuffey Abolitionist Center in Sumter, South Carolina, ready to ask you what we're going to do today, Brain.
Same thing we do every day, Pinky. Trying to take over the world.
Rats in
but
the cage.
Despite
man.
All our rage, we're still just rats in the cage, man. So last week, in honor of the passing of John Knipple, he's the treasurer of No Exceptions, North Carolina, and his slavery abolitionist legacy, we broadcasted that episode on involuntary servitude, where Max, John, and I were in the Paul Cuffey Abolitionist Center down in Sumter, South Carolina. It's a great episode, and it was just great hearing John's voice again. So this week we're going to be joined by New Hampshire activist. That's right, New Hampshire activist, abolitionist, and organizers Ophelia Healing Justice and New Hampshire State Representative Amanda Bolden. No relation. Ophelia and Amanda represent the grassroots organizing and legislative efforts behind New Hampshire's push to create a constitutional amendment officially abolishing slavery in the state for the first time. Now, it's said that New Hampshire abolished slavery in 1857. We'll show how that is not true at all, and we've got the receipts. And as always, we'll tie it together with great music and spoken word and bring the voices of the abolitionist ancestors back to life for a new generation. So, Max, before we bring in our guests, please share some updates on the slavery abolitionist movement. And, you know, we can also speak about our experiences out in Franklin, North Carolina with John's family.
It's been a busy couple of weeks. You know, we just brought in and hired our first full-time employee at the Abolish Slavery National Network. That's our new lead organizer, Dennis Febo. So he is on the job now. We're planning a launch for all of the states, although their bills would be coming in at different times from January up to like June. We're going to do a representation of the class of 2024 this coming January 31st, which is in tandem with the ratification of the 13th Amendment when it was passed by Congress on January 31st. So we're going to introduce the class of 2024, some of who are here with us today. And also, we are up to a lot of states, man, including the District of Columbia. So we've got 16 states on the table this year who are in various degrees of preparedness to get their bills in. We've got one state that's already going to be on the ballot. That's Nevada. And we also introduced representatives now that we have in Washington, D.C. You may not know it, but Washington, D.C.'s charter has an exception clause in it as well, put in there with the help of Abraham Lincoln himself. That was when they paid enslavers for how many slaves they lost. So we have a new lead organizer, Sarah, and she is only 17 years old, but she's brilliant, and she, with her and her family, they are ready to get it done. So Washington, D.C., we're about to remove slavery out of that for the first time, too. It's amazing when we say this first-time thing, people are like, what? I thought slavery was. No, it wasn't, because if it was, what are we doing? We've already done it in seven states, and we got 16 more coming, including D.C. So if it's been abolished, then what exactly are we doing? You know?
Exactly.
as you did say, we lost Brother John Knippel. He was a good man. I knew him personally. I'm glad I got to speak to him before his passing. His family are good people, and they live up in North Carolina. So there's kind of two veins to speak of there. One, North Carolina, of course, and also the his homegoing, because, you know, in the black community, we call it a homegoing. It was nice to see all of his family, his kids, his grandkids all there. So many people whose lives he had touched in his 72 years here. And to see his beautiful wife, Teresa, and speak with her, it was a very touching moment. I had to fight back tears a couple of times, you know, because we lost a good one.
Right.
But I understand we're going to lose a lot more good ones before we're done. And we'll all meet together, in my opinion, when it's all finished. Yusuf?
Yeah, just to ditto everything that you said, I mean, John left an amazing legacy behind, and not just, you know, a family legacy, but he left a legacy of abolition in the minds and the hearts of his family, you know, and it was just, in talking with them, I didn't realize how much he spoke about you and I to his family, you know, and the abolition movement, and that's all they were telling me. And I really, you know, would like to thank Teresa, his wife, you know, because instead of receiving flowers, she asked everyone to make donations to No Exceptions North Carolina. And, you know, there was a moment where I was sitting in the back of the church on the reception little area, and it was just like people lined up to hand me checks, you know, for No Exceptions North Carolina. And I let them all know. I said, you know, by handing me this check, that now makes you a slavery abolitionist because you're putting your money into this. And they all agreed, you know. So we have a whole bunch of Knippels that are slavery abolitionists now out in Western North Carolina. And they
and
all want to come.
Adjacent.
Exactly, exactly. So they will be at our next meeting, you know, looking to help us to abolish involuntary servitude, which is just slavery by another name here in North Carolina.
Yeah, it was kind of mind-blowing. I told him, I said, you know, California is the largest incarcerator in the country with 31 or 32 prisons, so somewhere along that line, 70 factories built into the prisons themselves. They got like 40 million people. North Carolina has got a quarter of what they have in population, but they got 54 prisons. Like, what the hell are you doing with 54 prisons? But, you know, I'm driving through there on the way up North Carolina, as always, up, you know, those mountains, across those curling roads, and, you know, where the drop is 1,000 feet. Man, those roads drive me nuts. Anyway, we get up there, and it's big old Trump signs, and you see Confederate flags, and, you know, we stopped at a few restaurants, and we were the only people of color in there, other than it was some Hispanic people, but we were the only black people there. So, you know, that was the environment of North Carolina. But anyway, it was beautiful to see the family, and the updates have been given. Let's go ahead and bring in our guests today, because I've been looking forward to this conversation with Ophelia and Amanda.
Yeah, this is going to be really good. So a little bit about our two guests this evening. The first is Healing Justice organizer Ophelia Burnett. She's been a New Hampshire resident for 30 years and is currently the Healing Justice organizer for the nonprofit organization American Friends Service Committee, where she works with formerly and currently incarcerated individuals. She's been directly impacted by the carceral system by spending 4 years in the New Hampshire State Prison for Women. Ophelia brings her life experiences and passion to her role as a Healing Justice organizer. She has also decided to start her own reentry program for individuals starting over after incarceration to assist in navigating community resources for successful outcomes. And we also will be joined by New Hampshire State Representative Amanda Bolden. She's the state representative in her fifth term in the New Hampshire House of Representatives. She works full-time for a nonprofit organization that encourages young, diverse people to run for public office. In 2011, she established Shire Sharing, an all-volunteer nonprofit that provides meals to families and individuals in need throughout New Hampshire. Amanda lives in Manchester with her mother, Linda, and two dogs, Jack and Max. That's Max with two X's. She is a single parent to her son, Will, a freshman at the University of New Hampshire. As a lawmaker, Amanda has prioritized criminal justice reform, drug policy reform, sentencing and prison reform, and overall human rights, and they both are slavery abolitionists. Welcome to the program, Ophelia and Amanda. Whoops, I did it backwards.
Got it. Welcome.
How's it going?
Sorry about that.
Hey, you guys. Thanks for having me. Thanks for having us.
Well, you know, we've got to know Ophelia a little bit. We were together out in Colorado for the anniversary of the Abolish Slavery National Network. You are a beautiful soul, very dedicated to getting this work done. And you have been doing nothing but learning ever since we met, you know. Go ahead.
You know what's funny, Max? I'm sorry to cut you off, but when you said learning, it just made me think of it even more, and I had to say it. When you guys first started and you said, hey, Pinky and Brain, what are you doing today? And he's like, yeah, you know, trying to take over the world. I say that all the time with my friends, so I just thought that was awesome that you guys said that. So I appreciate you guys saying that just now.
Awesome. Yeah, I was saying it, of course, in relation to the song. You know, despite all our rage, we're still just rats in a cage.
Yeah.
Indeed. And yeah. Sister Amanda, I've had some decent conversations with as well. One of the things that she is very proud about that I pointed out to her. Well, you know what? I'll let you explain it, Amanda.
Well, if you're getting at what I think you're getting at, I want to say, Yusuf, you said no relations, but I think there's probably a relation. If you have American slave ancestry, there's only so many Boldens. Sorry to break it to you,
right,
but we're probably like fourth or fifth cousins. And I know this because, like, I've gotten on, I have my DNA online, and you can use, like, drop-downs. And I did, like, the paternal line, like, the drop-down for paternal line and the drop-down to narrow by at least 10% sub-Saharan African DNA. And there's just a whole bunch of much darker complected fourth and fifth cousins that I have out there. So, and also, when I was raised, I was told, anybody who's a Bolden, no matter how they spell it, probably from our bloodline. So we should look into that. But yeah, I have ancestors who were slave owners, and two of them are congressmen for Virginia. And my fourth great-grandfather, James Bolden, made a whole speech one day that I was able to look up the transcript for, where he said it's a man's natural right to own another man. I'm really happy to ruin everything they'd ever hoped for, not only in that regard,
right,
but also because I'm a woman who's not married, who owns property, who I get to have my own money, and I'm a lawmaker, and I think that they'd literally, like, cry and fall over dead if they knew that.
They'd be rolling over in their graves.
You
rebel, you.
Yeah, your property would have automatically been your husband's property.
Yeah, so there's a lot to be happy about in my life, because I know that my own ancestors wouldn't have wanted me to have it. And, you know, there's so much that they wouldn't have wanted many other people to experience in life.
Go ahead. One of the things I wanted to ask you, I don't think I've ever asked in any of our conversations, is how did you find out? Because I remember Ophelia telling me she had heard about us or something like that, and she went and looked and said, oh, yeah, that's right. Is that how it worked out? Tell me how this began in New Hampshire. You said, you know, we need to end slavery in New Hampshire.
Well, okay, so like a few years ago, I saw 13th, the documentary, and then I put in a bill calling, it was a resolution calling on Congress to close the loophole. And that went nowhere, but it was fun. And I didn't know that there was anyone out there who, like, knew about stuff like this or cared about it. And I met Ophelia because she's always at the State House. I'm on the Criminal Justice Committee because we get to deal with a lot of bills that I find interesting. And Ophelia is always there lobbying on those bills, giving testimony, giving her personal experience. And we started talking then she told me that she runs a monthly prison abolition meeting. And I was like, what? This is a thing? Like, and I joined. And then during the meeting that we were having on Juneteenth, someone brought up the Abolish Slavery National Network. And then I looked it up and I was like, there's no New Hampshire group. And I wrote in. And here we are.
Yeah. Awesome. Yep. And you know, when we first started talking, one of the first things I've clarified is we are not prison abolitionists. We're slavery abolitionists. Ophelia, you want to talk about that?
Yes, absolutely. Because when you guys had your, annual celebration in Denver, Colorado, and, you know, I'm just learning about this stuff and, you know, we're all learning when it comes to this. And so when I was there and, you know, I'm talking with you guys and we're having our meetings and we are strategizing and things like that, you know, I thought it was just one thing, was prison abolition. And I found out there's four different types of abolition. And Max or Yusuf, if you can remind me, I know there's prison abolition.
There's four
slavery
narratives.
Abolition. There's
right.
four narratives. Okay.
Four narratives. Prison abolition,
yes.
as you said, slavery
mm-hmm.
abolition, as you said, then there is prison slavery abolition. And then there is criminal justice reform.
Okay.
The difference is real quick. Criminal justice reform is very much, you know, self-evident by changing certain things or removing little things. You can reform the system to make it better. Prison slavery abolition focuses primarily on the labor aspect happening in prison,
mm-hmm.
which is an $11 billion a year industry. Then you have prison abolition, which is focused, of course, on dismantling the entire system and getting rid of the prisons
right.
and reimagining a world or a country that doesn't have these types of systems. And then last is slavery abolition, which is what we advocate because we see this as a crime against humanity and we want to address it as such.
Amen.
Yeah, and for anyone that wants to hear further on that, you can refer to our April 2nd episode from Season 4, Episode 12, The Blind Men and the Elephant, where Max breaks down all four of the narratives.
You know,
I'm not sure
things...
if I was there that night. Was I there that night? I don't think
no,
I was there with you that
you
night.
You were sick, I believe. That was why I did a solo. So,
okay.
Yep, you were either sick or out for some reason, but I did a solo because you were unavailable at that point, which was cool. I got those four narratives out. But there's been some things going on in little old New Hampshire, the Shire. You know, you think of like hobbits and stuff like that. But, yeah, the Shire. There's been some things going down there. One of the things that happened just recently is there was an attempt to pass a law. It went through Congress or through the House at least. It's called the Law Prohibiting Racial Profiling in Law Enforcement and Sentencing. And that was in March of 2023. I watched a video on it where they were talking about, you know, how there's so much racial profiling going on in the state of New Hampshire. And Yusuf and I did the research, and it's in 2019, your rate of incarceration per 100,000 was 10 to 1. There's like, what, 25
mm-hmm.
black people in New Hampshire?
Oh, my goodness. You guys are funny.
Yeah, and the rate of incarceration is like 10 to 1. It doesn't mean that there's 10 black people in prison for every one white person. It means per 100,000, they arrest 10 black people versus one white person. And that's crazy to even think of, but that is the way it is across the whole country. Any comments you want to make on that? The law or the rate?
Well, the funny thing is that New Hampshire usually considers itself less racist, and there's absolutely this, and I'm a former Texan, right? So, like, there's just notable vibe in the New England area where they think that because they're inheriting being on the right side of the Civil War, that they're somehow absolved and never guilty. And that's been part of the... That was the slogan that came out of a lot of the stuff in 2020 when BLM got really active in New Hampshire. They said, New Hampshire is not innocent. And there's definitely a severe thread of othering and, like, outsider suspicion running through New Hampshire because, incidentally, the economics of the state not a lot of people move here to begin their lives. They begin their lives here incidentally and end up leaving for something better just from an economic perspective. So xenophobia is really common here because so much of the population has just always been here for generations, and a lot of people that run for office will brag on how long their families have been in the area. Mm. So there's definitely a theme in New Hampshire of being suspicious of someone who seems like they don't belong. But I think maybe Ophelia can speak to that better than I can.
Ophelia?
You know, yeah, when you were asking that question, Max, I didn't know that you were speaking to me and Amanda, but there's this one saying that a lot of people say, you come on vacation, leave on probation, and that's been known
wow.
in New Hampshire for a very long time.
Wow.
Yeah. 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 And it's very true, you know, and being here for over 30 years, I'm 38 now, and doing the work that I do now, seeing so many people being incarcerated and just that cycle, and a lot of the people are black and brown. So, you know, doing this, you know, abolishing slavery, I'm really excited about it, and getting it into legislation for next year is really important to me. So, and this racial profiling thing that you guys are talking about, I know we were speaking earlier about having some type of system to show what kind of people are being pulled over or being harassed, and having some kind of system to show who are you guys pulling over. Is it black and brown people? Is it Caucasian people? And for some reason, every time we try to bring that up to have that kind of system, you know, put into place, they're like, no, we don't want to have that. But it's like, why is that? Because we know that you guys are mostly pulling over black and brown people. So that's something that, you know, before I started getting to this work, we were trying to work on for New Hampshire. But next year, I'm really going to be advocating very hard to having that system put into place, because I'm very curious. I mean, I already know, because I work with these people being incarcerated and seeing it for myself. But there's people, I won't say their names, but they're like, well, where do you see that? Like, how do you think that it's only black and brown people being incarcerated? Well, look into the jails, look into the prisons, you'll see it. You know, so that's my opinion on that.
Thank you. You know, New Hampshire has felt that it's necessary to enact a law preventing racial profiling, not only in law enforcement, with what we call slave catchers, but also in sentencing. And we've also talked
right.
about how you've got these white supremacists out there that have formed organized groups where they're terrorizing people with their signs over the bridges, as well as
mm-hmm.
Avoiding certain charges. So, but that's not the end of it. You know, we're not ragging on New Hampshire. We're just pulling up some of the recent stuff that's going on out there. And I've got one more I want to share with you real quick. It's part of a clip, a few minutes long. It's Charles Blow, the journalist, and he's talking about how 10 New Hampshire council members resigned over a ban on CRT. Now, this happened in 2021, but that ban is in effect. It's going to be followed by Eric Clapton's This Has Got to Stop. You're listening to Abolition Today, abolitiontoday.org, with Max Parthas and Yusuf Hassan. We are joined today by organizer Ophelia Healing Justice and New Hampshire State Representative Amanda Bolden. We'll be right back after this.
Abolition. Abolition.
Today.
Republicans continue their ridiculous crusade to ban critical race theory, no matter how it makes them look and regardless of the consequences. Yesterday, Governor Chris Sununu of New Hampshire lost 10 of the 17 members of his diversity council, including Representative Jen Majori. New Hampshire's Republican legislature passed a bill to ban critical race theory and systemic racism being taught in schools, and the governor signed it. In a letter to Governor Sununu, the resigned members wrote, "It should not be taken lightly that nearly every member of the council that is not part of your administration is resigning today, as we collectively see no path forward with this legislation in place. One of the provisions of the bill specifically focuses on the public education system and limits how teachers can speak about racism. In a way, it makes it easier for individuals to sue local schools or teachers if they discuss racism or critical race theory in class. The real danger in this bill, the council members note, is censorship. Teachers could be afraid of getting sued for simply telling the truth in their classrooms.
This time gotta stop, enough is enough. I can't take this BS any longer. It's gone far enough. You wanna claim my soul, you'll have to come and break down this door. I've been around a long, long time, seen it all, and I'm used to being free. I know who I am, try to do what's right, so lock me up and throw away the key. But this time's gotta stop, enough is enough. I can't take this BS any longer. It's gone far enough. You wanna claim my soul, you'll have to come and break down this door.
I was thinking the same thing, Yusuf. I'm sorry.
You just heard Charles Blow on the 10 New Hampshire council members resigning over the ban on critical race theory. And that was accompanied by Eric Clapton's "This Has Gotta Stop." And that line, "I can't take this BS anymore, man." You know, because as he was mentioning about the banners, I realized that the judge back in June actually dismissed the complaint against them. After all of that. So I'm like, wow, this group, National Socialist Club, they also call themselves NSC 131. So
yeah.
Ophelia.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
You heard the clip, and I see it got you riled up already.
Yeah, it does. I just kept on, like, that guy's name clapped, and I felt like I was getting clapped, like, every minute, like, clap, clap, clap. Like, I just felt like I kept on getting hit in every direction, and it's like, you know, just going back to the, you know,
oh my God, the critical race theory. And so I remember, now I know what that was. And when we were talking about it earlier, I was like, what? What are you guys talking about? I was like, oh yeah, so that goes back to when I was telling you guys back when we were in Denver, they had this bill that was passed called the Divisive Concept Bill, which it would prohibit teachers from talking about racism and sexism in school. And so when I started getting to know more about the, you know, the abolishing slavery and things like that, I'm like, they are really trying to just erase slavery from history. And that is a part of our history. And they're really just trying to erase all of that from, like, schools and things like that. And I'm like, how can they do that? And, like, now they really just passed a bill here in New Hampshire called the Divisive Concept Bill, where it prohibits the teachers from talking about it. And when I heard this, not last year, but the year before, I'm like, can they really do that? Like, how is this even possible? And it's like, yeah, they can, you know? So it just blew my mind when I first heard about it. And it's like, it just fueled me to even want to do this work even more. So that's why when I met you guys, and even though all the stuff that you guys are teaching me with abolishing slavery and the 13th Amendment is new to me, and, you know, with the exception clause, I'm just like, you know, give it to me. Like, I need to know more, and I need to be doing this, because this is just absurd, you know. And with those guys, with the NCR 131 or whoever they're really not that important, but I mean, I hear what you're saying. They, you know, hanging the banners and they, you know, dismiss their case. I guess they were saying that we were kind of like, you know, not going against their First Amendment, which is like, you know, freedom of speech. But it's like, really, when is enough? Because if black people, you know, if black people went up there and put up like, you know, black people are this or whatever, we'd be getting, you know, hung and shot down and this and the third. We wouldn't even get a chance to even be able to get up on there before the cops come and start, you know, telling us to get down and things like that. So it's like, how is it like, It's just not fair. So, like, I'm sorry. I'm just, like, really heated right now, because I just, that whole clip that you guys just played was just so much to take in all at once, you know, so.
I hear you. Yeah. Thank you. I'll feel you. Amanda, opinion. Would you like to chime in?
So the sponsor of the House bill to ban divisive concepts, as they called it, I had a conversation with him a few years ago in the they call it the ante room, but it's like a lounge for legislators behind the room where we vote. And we were between bills or something, and I was sitting with him talking about a bill I had just put in that I intended to give incarcerated people more autonomy in their healthcare choices. So I was describing it to him, and I'm like, so this is, would enable you to get a second opinion from an outside doctor if you disagree with the prison doctor, And he says to me, and like, it hit me hard. He goes, how much socialism is enough, Amanda? And I'm like, what are you talking about? This isn't socialism. You're the one who wants a prison. Like, how much more expensive do you think it's going to be when you pay out all these lawsuits for poor health care? And in the midst of it all these people are going to die or just suffer the consequences of insufficient health care. And you're telling me that you're a fiscal conservative, but you're opposed to the idea of giving someone proper health care at the beginning, and you'd rather just pay the consequences at the end. When it's, for example, we had a woman in a jail in Manchester who gave birth to a stillborn child on the floor of the jail, and she ended up winning a measly $40,000 payout. But there's no, you know, who pays that at the end of the day is taxpayers.
Right.
And supposed fiscal conservatives don't want to run a humane facility, and he considers it socialism. And so it's no surprise that later on he goes to file legislation to try to interfere with even having a conversation about whether or not slavery was unethical. I mean, that's what that legislation gets to the heart of, is describing and having conversations with students about whether or not these things that happened were wrong, which is honestly terrifying if we can't even talk to children about that.
Right.
You know, conservatives have a couple of ideas in their heads that are basically inhumane and lead to crimes against humanity. The first is that everybody who's in a jail or a prison must have done something to deserve to be there. Nobody's criminalized in their eyes. Everybody is a criminal, and they relate them with the worst of the worst. So even if you're in there for tax evasion, or it's your third strike, or if it's just jaywalking, whatever the hell it is, they're like, these are rapists and murderers and child molesters, and that's how they look at them. And the second thing is, once people cross that threshold into jail and prison, get caught up in the system, any concern for them is almost completely lost, you know? Like, right. People really just don't care about them. And that's what I hear when you tell me what he said. When is socialism enough? Because he's looking at you as some kind of bleeding heart liberal who cares about rapists and murderers and child molesters.
Maybe that might not be too far from the truth, because at the end of the day, they say that it's in the state constitution in New Hampshire that the purpose of incarceration or punishment in general is to reform, not to punish. There's some wording along those lines, but they say to reform. And so the intent, at least in the 1700s, when they, you know, wrote a state constitution, was that when you're incarcerating people, that they should come out better than they went in. But that's, I think, almost never the case with the current incarceration system. That's right. It's so wacky.
Just this week, John Oliver did a whole segment on the healthcare in the prisons, which is a fascinating segment. I suggest people watch it if they have the opportunity. But that's what you were fighting against, is that they have these monopolies, and they're incentivized to provide less health care rather than good health care. They're given a standard amount of pay for the health care they'll provide for that year, and the more health care they provide, the less money they're going to make. And so you see a lot of these problems with people, like you said, end up dying in prison. I remember they had one guy had cancer, and they told him to put some kind of salve on it or whatever. Like, what are you talking about? But in any case, I mean, this is the type of health care that they get. So you're fighting the good fight to save literal lives of people who got caught up in the system. And he's looking at you like I said, some kind of leftist, bleeding heart liberal who shouldn't care about those people at all.
And yeah, and if we actually want them to be reformed, then why are we interfering with their health care? Why are we interfering with their access to mental health care? Why are we interfering with their access to care related to maybe a substance misuse disorder? And then there's the whole aspect of when you're incarcerated, if you have rent to pay, nobody pays it. If you have stuff in your apartment, your landlord puts it on the curb. At least that's kind of the vibe in New Hampshire. And then people pick at it, and then the trash takes it someday. And if you have a car and you stop making payments, then the bank comes and takes your car. And then by the time you get out, all you have is what they arrested you with. And so the idea that prison is in any capacity reforming is bonkers. But the least that we could do for people is try to piecemeal through the legislative process and through outside activism, give people access to basic things to keep them afloat from a health and mental health perspective, so that when they do get out, maybe they have a chance at rebuilding their lives. And that's a lot of what Ophelia does with the American Friends Service Committee. Right, Ophelia?
Absolutely, yes.
Would you like to say anything about it, Ophelia?
Oh, no, just different things that I do as far as, like, policy work, advocating. I'm at the beginning stages of starting a reentry program and focusing a lot on individual healing. You know, they're saying that these facilities are departments of corrections, but they're not correcting anything, like Amanda was just saying. So, you know, really focusing on when people are coming home, working on their healing, their trauma, and getting them prepared for success, you know, getting them connected with resources, you know, job training, things like that, and really lessening that recidivism rate here in New Hampshire, because that's one of the reasons why it's so high, because individuals like myself, thank God for my family, my mother, who was very supportive of me when I came home. A lot of individuals don't have that support system. So when they are being released, they let you go, and you're pretty much just a loose chicken just running around, and they expect you to get a job, get housing, but are anybody helping you with that? Is anybody helping you get into housing? And when you're incarcerated and you come home, now you're a felon. And one of the biggest things when you're a felon, it's hard for you to get housing and it's hard for you to get a job. And those are the two mm-hmm. big things that you're supposed to get when you get out. And if not, you're going back into the prison. So that's why that cycle just keeps on going. And so that's one of the barriers that I want to, you know, get rid of so that people can be successful is helping them with the resources, helping them with housing, and really helping with that, you know, those core issues and healing the trauma and things like that, because, you know, they're causing more harm on individuals being incarcerated. So if I can help heal that, people will come out and be more happier, and they're not going to want to come out and do, because people are having more mental issues when they come out after incarceration. And they're saying that putting people into prisons and jails is going to make the community safe. And actually, studies show that when people are incarcerated, they come out and they're actually worse than when they went in, and cause more harm and commit more serious crimes when they come out. So that is my main focus, you know, being the healing justice organizer that I am with American Friends Service Committee, and just really being out there in community and seeing what the people want and helping with that instead of, you know, being a part of the broken system. And so, yeah, that's a lot of the work that I do.
As slavery abolitionists.
Well, thank you so much for that.
Yeah.
As slavery abolitionists, we are very holistic in our perspective. We know that the system of slavery does not begin and end behind prison walls. It begins mm-hmm. in the cradle and ends long after a person has served their time with mm-hmm. the consequences that happen after you get out, places where you can't vote, you can't get particular jobs, you can't get assistance with housing, and on and on and on. It's almost as if it is set up to capture people when they're young and exploit mm-hmm. them when they're older and take them out of the system so that they are now second-class citizens with no rights that can be respected. But there's some good news in all of this that just happened on September 28th. The UN has released a report after doing their own investigation. It comes from the UN Mechanism on Racial Justice and Law Enforcement. And I've read the report. It's quite long, but there's a few articles that have come out from the Associated Press and elsewhere. Let me read a little bit about it. They said that in all the cities we went to, we heard dozens of heartbreaking testimonies on how victims do not get justice or redress. This is not new, and it's unacceptable, said Tracy Cassie, an expert member of the mechanism. This is a system issue that calls for a systemic response. All actors involved, including police departments and police unions, must join forces to combat the prevailing impunity. Now, there's two words they're going to say in here you should pay attention to. First, the report found that racism in the U.S., a legacy of slavery, the slave trade, and 100 years of legalized apartheid that followed slavery's abolition continue to exist today in the form of racial profiling, police killings, and many other human rights violations. The report said that black people in America are 3 times more likely to be killed by police than whites and 4.5 times more likely to be incarcerated. It also said of the more than 1,000 cases of killings by police each year, only 1% result in officers being charged. If use of force regulations in the U.S. are not reformed in accordance with the international standards, many of these killings will continue. They call this a modern form of slavery, like literally in the report. They also said that this is apartheid, which has continued to this day. Mm-hmm. And that's what we've been talking about here today. What you're dealing with is slavery and apartheid. Let's go ahead to Amanda. Any comments on the UN report?
That's kind of the funny thing about it is, I guess New Hampshire tries to toot its own horn for banning slavery in New Hampshire in the 1800s, but not in any substantial way, and then they still allow for slavery within the carceral system in New Hampshire. And going back to like how in New England, so many people want to take credit for just happening to be in New England, you know, so long after the Civil War, they want credit, suggesting that their ancestors, by virtue of just living here, were somehow anti-racist or anti-slavery, when, you know, we couldn't possibly know what their positions really were. They just lived in the area when the Civil War, you know, when that kind of fell, however it fell. But there's so many people involved in the system in different capacities who are taking credit but not willing to actually pay the effort to create anything.
I want to read one more paragraph, and then I want to get Ophelia's thoughts on this. The other paragraph is this. It says, the report cited with profound concern instances of children of African descent being sentenced to life imprisonment, pregnant women in prison being chained during childbirth, and persons held in solitary confinement for 10 years. It also describes how some people of African descent have been prevented from voting years after completing their sentences, and how some are subjected to forced labor in plantation-style prisons, which constitutes a contemporary form of slavery. Ophelia?
I'm just floored by all of this. You know, like I said, I'm just saddened by all of it. I was taking this training a couple months ago with the National Council for Incarcerated and Formerly Incarcerated Women and Girls, and I had learned about another prison where women that would come in, this was like years and years ago, but women that were coming in that were pregnant and they were having babies, and obviously it was Black and brown women, and if they were pregnant, they would have their babies in the prison. Their babies were getting taken away and then buried in the back of the prison. Mm-hmm. And it was still there. And just, it's just, I just can't believe that a lot of this stuff. And then what really bothers me is me being a woman of color and living in New Hampshire, and I'm just now learning about all this stuff. And that's why, like, as you guys are talking about all this stuff now, I'm just, like, in silence, because I'm just like, wow, I can't believe all this has happened, you know, to my ancestors. And, you know, and this is why they're trying to erase it from history and from the schools and things like that, because they don't want people like myself to know about this and want to do something about it now for the future moving forward. It's just crazy because, like I said, I'm 38 years old and I'm just now learning about this. And it's not like it's something that I learned in school, because they barely touch on this stuff. I literally had to learn it from another organization or from a training that taught me these things. And it's like they come up with things like the divisive concept bill, where they don't want it to be taught in schools. Like, they're literally trying to erase it from history. So I'm just, like I said, I'm just mm-hmm. like, you know, so taken by all of this that you guys are talking about.
It can be frustrating, especially when we're talking about banning CRT is effectively a gag order on slavery. And it's the same thing they did to us in the antebellum period around the 1850s, where you weren't allowed to even talk about this issue in Congress or the Senate. There was a jail term attached to speaking about it. But now what they do is they block us in our committees. They won't give us hearings on the issue set that the people won't even get a chance to decide whether or not they want slavery in the state. So usually you have some kingpin who calls himself the committee chairman that gets to decide for the whole state whether or not that they are going to vote on ending slavery. And that's a gag order.
Right.
But this was a huge thing that we just mentioned with the UN. This is an international declaration on what's going on with their own research and their own investigation, coming to the same conclusions that we all have been coming to, that these are crimes against humanity beyond mm-hmm. torture, and that
right.
it's part of a system of slavery and apartheid, and it has to end. You can't fix that. You cannot reform a crime against humanity. You have to abolish it. It's the only answer to it. And there's more good news, too. And I want to share that good news in a track we're going to play. And when we come back on the other side, I want to kill that noise about how New Hampshire abolished slavery in 1857, okay? What you're about to hear is the passing of ACA 8 through committee in California just a few couple of weeks ago. And that's going to be followed by William Lloyd Garrison's speech, No Compromise with the Evil of Slavery, by Alika Hope and the Ray of Hope Project. Now, I don't have the name of the speaker speaking on behalf of ACA 8. I apologize for that. But nonetheless, we are going to share his words. You're listening to Abolition Today, abolitiontoday.org, with Max Parthas and Yusuf Hassan. We're joined by Ophelia and Amanda out of New Hampshire, and we'll be right back after this.
Abolition. Abolition.
Today. The history of slavery in California's prison system is directly tied to racial capitalism, white supremacy, and the subjugation of black and indigenous people. Although California no longer uses the public auction block, our current prison system still practices slavery under the guise of involuntary servitude, which is simply slavery by another name. This euphemism does not hide the fact that slavery in any form is an evil institution and has no place in California or anywhere else for that matter. It also doesn't hide the fact that the vast majority of people forced and coerced to labor in today's prison slave system are black or have indigenous ancestry. Last November, voters in four states, including Alabama, y'all, approved ballot measures that changed their state constitutions to prohibit slavery and involuntary servitude as punishment for crime. It's imperative that this legislature allow California voters the opportunity to reject slavery in all its forms now and forever.
While the labor was changed to manufacturing, farming, and firefighting, the system of slavery is still largely the same. Cheap labor being performed by over-criminalized black and brown people. The 1800s seems so far removed from 2023, but we aren't as progressive as we think we are. When I entered prison at 19, I asked my counselor to place me in school to finish my high school education. Instead, I was assigned to the yard crew to hoe hard dirt for hours. If I would have refused to report to the yard crew to finish school, I would have been put on C status. C status is a custody level that results in loss of privileges, no phone calls, no quarterly packages, a $45 shopping limit on canteen for toiletries per month. You are only allowed out of your cell for 3 days a week for a total of 6 hours for the week to wash clothes, and if you're lucky, you can go outside if the yard is open. C-status can be the difference from board denying you a day and granting your freedom. As directly impacted people, members of Sister Warrior Freedom Coalition, and our partner organizations, we know firsthand the most incarcerated people want to work. We believe they should be able to choose jobs that align with their skills to better position them to secure a job upon release, or to be able to continue their education and participate in programs that facilitate post-release success.
Heard the stories of people who have gone through COVID and needing to essentially risk their lives for fear of the punitive measures in terms of taking away credits or impacting the way that they or being put into solitary confinement if they refuse to perform their work. So they essentially had to risk their lives for certain in order to be able to ensure that they could comply. And that is by definition what involuntary servitude is. So it is time in the state of California that we make sure that we put into our constitution the fact that we are not going to accept involuntary servitude as a fact of life for anybody, and certainly not for people who are incarcerated.
The legacy of slavery and forced labor runs deep in California's history, from the exploitation of indigenous people in Spanish missions to black slaves forced to mine for gold. So California entered the Union as a free state, free with quotes around it. There were more than 1,000 enslaved African Americans, as well as thousands of enslaved indigenous people in California, at a time when the total population was just 100,000 people. Today, slavery takes on the modern form of involuntary servitude, including forced labor in prison. Slavery is wrong in all forms, and California should be clear in denouncing that in our Constitution.
I am a believer in that portion of the Declaration of American Independence in which it is set forth as among self-evident truths that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Hence, I am an abolitionist. Convince me that one man may rightfully make another man his slave, and I will no longer subscribe to the Declaration of Independence. Every slave is a stolen man. Every slaveholder is a man-stealer. By no precedent, no example, no law, no compact, no purchase, no bequest, no inheritance, no combination of circumstances is slaveholding right or justifiable. While a slave remains in his fetters, the land must have no rest. Whatever sanctions his doom must be pronounced accursed. The law that makes him a chattel is to be trampled underfoot. The compact that is formed at his expense and cemented with his blood is null and void. The church that consents to his enslavement is horribly atheistical. The religion that receives to its communion the enslaver is the embodiment of all criminality. Such, at least, is the verdict of my own soul. On the supposition that I am to be the slave, that my wife is to be sold from me for the vilest of purposes, that my children are to be torn from my arms and disposed of to the highest bidder, like sheep in the marketplace, living or dying, defeated or victorious, be it ours to exclaim, no compromise with slavery. Liberty for each, for all, forever.
Abolition. Abolition. Today. Abolition. Today. Today.
You just heard a testimony from ACA 8 in assembly in 2023, and that was followed by William Lloyd Garrison's speech, No Compromise with the Evil of Slavery, by Alika Hope and the Ray of Hope Project. Welcome back to Abolition Today, abolitiontoday.org, with Max Parthas and Yusuf Hassan. Tonight our guests are Ophelia and Amanda from New Hampshire. And he said it best right there in that speech. Every slave is a stolen man. Every slaveholder is a man stealer. Can't be any plain, yeah. any more plain than that. So I will pass it to you first, Amanda, for any comments on what you just heard in that track.
Congratulations to California, too, by the way.
They've been working hard out there.
Mm-hmm.
Really hard.
But I think when it comes to humanizing the realities of enslavement, that's something I think that is easily glossed over in the history books, and when kids are educated in schools, it's hard to understand what it would feel like to be in that sort of experience. And when we're talking about, systemic racism and the laws and systems that continue to exist today, it's hard to imagine that the people implementing those or running those systems are themselves of the same mindset of the people who were choosing to own other people and beat them and starve them and control their lives. But the attitudes and views and hatefulness of those people survived through the systems that they created. So we have the same prison system, almost the same laws, the same court system today with few changes over time. And it's one of those things, there's so many aspects of life where you don't question the status quo. You say to yourself, it's always been like this. This is how my family did it, or this is how my society does it. And you don't stop to question the impact that it has, or whether it's necessary, or whether it actually achieves the goals that it claims to pursue. And that is the systemic racism, at least as far as I understand it, and forgetting, really losing access to the real human impact of enslavement.
I did a mix there in that production with William Lloyd Garrison's speech in order to show a lot of the similarities then and now. you know, and the things that we were talking about. Like, this is not a conspiracy. You're actually listening to people who are giving testimony in 2023 in California about ending involuntary servitude, which is another name for slavery. And that was, of course, followed by Lloyd Garrison and his testimony on how he felt about it. Because it's true, this is a crime against humanity. If you say that you can force people to labor for free, that you own their bodies, that you can actually sell stocks in prison stocks and jail bonds on the open market in order for people to invest in the imprisonment of others, it's a slave trade now, you know, Ophelia?
No, I just never, you know, understood how some states could, you know, have this on the ballot to abolish slavery, and some states were still okay with having it and thought it was okay. Like, I just never understood that. You know, so, you know, congratulations to California for this, because, like I said, some states just thought it was still okay to have this, and I just don't understand that. Like, they just think it's okay to still have this in their constitution.
I do still want to kill that noise about what New Hampshire allegedly did, but before I do that, I want to tag on along with California's win to New Hampshire's move forward. You started the process of introducing a bill. Amanda, you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, that goes back to how, like, the funny stuff about Ophelia and I coming to understand that we had similar interests, like some subject matter areas, because I saw 13th, and as a, I got to say, like, being a state rep in New Hampshire is not a big deal. And whenever people call me representative, I'm like, no, it's just Amanda, because we have the largest state legislature in the country. We have 400 state reps, and the next highest is Pennsylvania with 200 and something. So it's like an obscene number of state lawmakers. So you just trip over them. And but yeah, that aside, it's knowing, like, I am prone to watching John Oliver episodes and getting so pissed off and wanting to put in legislation and having to, like, schedule a reminder for myself for when it's time to file legislation. And that's what happened. I put in legislation calling on Congress, U.S. Congress, to close the loophole in the 13th Amendment. And it never went anywhere. But then I met Ophelia, and we got connected with you guys. And, you know, now we have legislation in the works to initiate the process for a constitutional amendment. So constitutional amendments have to go to the voters on the ballot in New Hampshire. So if we were to pass this, we'd have a measure on the ballot next fall. We'd have a measure on the November ballot to add a clause to the state constitution explicitly banning enslavement and involuntary servitude.
I'm cheesing. Let me give you flowers real quick. You deserve your flowers for making this thing move forward. And you're also part of something else that sets precedence. In the United States, we had 25 states that had exception clauses of various degrees. And we had 25 states that had no language whatsoever, and they fell under the 13th Amendment, whether it had been ratified by that state or not. So they were subject to the federal amendment, which still allowed for slavery. And in the states that we've done it so far, we've removed the language that allowed for slavery, the pro-slavery language. But there are states like your own who want to insert anti-slavery language in order to protect their citizens from the 13th Amendment itself. And that's a shame that we have to do something like that, and it comes down to state rights. But that's what you're attempting to do, which is also setting precedents. And I look forward to you achieving that goal.
That's right.
It's going to be a long process for sure, but I think it'll be a lot of excited to hear from anyone who wants to argue against this kind of change. And
you're
going to
have
to
tune in
noted.
Next week.
Well, I think it should be noted that New Hampshire has a weird, pretty active secession movement called NH Exit. and sort of like Brexit and CalExit and so forth. I think there's Texit in Texas. And, you know, Texas always wanted to be its own country. But so, that, yeah, there's folks here that want to secede from the union, and I don't think they'll ever be successful. But out of the 400 state reps, there was legislation introduced last year to secede. And I think 30 or so state reps voted for it, which isn't a lot. Yeah, I think it's a little south of 10% there, maybe. But still, that's a good number. And if New Hampshire were to ever secede, slavery would no longer be illegal in New Hampshire. And that's pretty significant.
That is very significant.
Exactly.
Not just to New Hampshire, but to the whole country. And also mm-hmm. it has implications internationally, because there's a lot of nations who have adopted our prison-for-profit model, and many of them don't have the type of rights that we possess here. Even though, you know, there's crimes against humanity happening here in the United States, there's levels of this. There's murder, and there's brutal murder, if you understand where I'm coming from. And many of these other countries that have adopted this model are just outrageous with what they're doing to their citizens there. I did say I wanted to kill that noise about 1857 in New Hampshire. So I did a little research, and I found some information via letters and legislation and legislators' comments. And most of it comes from slavenorth.com/newhampshire.htm. So you can read it for yourself if you like. It's also available on our Facebook page. And we're going to tell you exactly what they did at that time. The rhetoric, I'm going to read down into it, not from the very beginning, but it says, the rhetoric of revolution and liberty was felt here too, speaking of New Hampshire. But the practical effect was often wanting. In 1779, Prince Whipple, a slave of a New Hampshire Continental Army officer, and 18 other blacks sent a petition to the legislators seeking emancipation. They used revolutionary rhetoric and wrote that slavery was incompatible with justice, humanity, and the rights of mankind, but the petition was ignored. In 1783, state constitution declared all men are born equal and independent with natural rights, among which are enjoying and defending life and liberty. This was very close to the language that led via the courts to the end of slavery in Massachusetts, but there are no judicial records from New Hampshire to indicate that this was construed there as ending slavery. Many clearly felt it did, but whether for all slaves or only to children of slaves born after 1783, it is not clear. Slaves were removed from the rolls of taxable property in 1789, but the acts appears to have been for taxing purposes only. The 1790 census counted 158 slaves, but in 1800 there were only 8. Portsmouth traders participated legally in the slave trade until 1807. No slaves were counted for the state in 1810 and 1820, but 3 are listed in 1830 and 1 in 1840. And this here's the last part. A common accepted date for the end of slavery in New Hampshire is 1857, when an act was passed stating that no person, because of descent, should be disqualified from becoming a citizen of the state. The act is interpreted as prohibiting slavery by a strict interpretation. However, slavery was outlawed only on December 6, 1865, when the 13th Amendment went into effect. Well, we know that's not true. And ratified by New Hampshire July 1, 1865. So even the language doesn't say anything about slavery at all. At no point did they come out in New Hampshire and says slavery is abolished. At no point, even with an exception. Instead, they use some vague language that might include people allowed to become a citizen of the state. But that could have applied to anyone. It could have applied to foreign nationals. It could have applied to Native Americans. It didn't necessarily have anything to do with slavery. Comments?
No, I was waiting for that. Out of all that you were saying, Max, I was like, okay, I was waiting for it, waiting for it. Never came for it to be like, yes. It's abolished. So, yeah, yes, that's exactly true. It never said anything about abolishing slavery.
You know, when Ophelia invited me to speak to her abolition group, you know, Max, how much I love doing like a deep dive through the courts on what can I find on slavery. Absolutely nothing. I found not one case talking about slavery up in New Hampshire, with the exception of there was like a judicial suggestion when it came to sort of like the debtors' prisons. And the judges themselves said, oh, it's like a slippery slope, you know, that's going to have a constitutional problem down the road. But again, nothing. Nothing about, you know, slavery being abolished in New Hampshire. Nowhere. And as we just discussed a few minutes ago, New Hampshire automatically follows the 13th Amendment. So, yeah, that whole slavery ended in 1857.
Or 1789 or any year.
1850.
Never. Never happened.
Going back to BLM. New Hampshire with their BLM slogan in New Hampshire is New Hampshire is not innocent. It should be noted that a claim to fame sort of or infamy in New Hampshire is that we were the last state in the U.S. to declare MLK Day as a state holiday in addition to it being federally recognized. So it wasn't until 1999 that that became a holiday in New Hampshire. And definitely the state held out and avoided acknowledging him and his achievements and contributions as long as possible. And that entirely comes down to state representatives like me and like I'll make Ophelia be one day. But you know what I'm saying? There's nothing like mysterious or nefarious that results in us not acknowledging MLK Day. It's literal everyday normal people living in New Hampshire who, you know, they live in the district they represent. They talk to their neighbors. They go to the same grocery stores. And they refuse to acknowledge MLK Day. And there is a thread that runs through in New Hampshire that no one really likes to acknowledge, but that's definitely something BLM does with their slogan, New Hampshire is not innocent.
You know, Amanda,
I'm sorry,
go ahead.
No, I'm sorry, Max, but I know my girlfriend Wu is listening, but this is a perfect time for me to say this because I've said this before. Or Amanda, how about our slogan, live free or die? And it's like, you know, if, you know, black and brown people are not free,
wow.
I guess then we're dying. You know what I mean? So it's like, that's our slogan for New Hampshire, is live free or die. So what does that tell you?
Wow.
Right. Amanda, you mentioned earlier, I want to say about who would argue against ending slavery. And I said,
you got to tune in
next week, because next week our show is pro-slavery arguments. And I feel it's necessary for us to share them because in 2023, as well as in the past, there's always been this argument promoting keeping slavery. And I've heard almost all of them where they, you know, I've been through the hearings and the testimonies where senators stood up and talked about how they want to keep this system going in Ohio and Louisiana and New Jersey and Oregon.
Yeah.
You know, like I've heard it with my own ears that there are many out there
right.
who will argue you
and
to
what is
death.
Their and Max, I'm sorry, what is their reasoning? Because that's what I was saying. Like, I don't understand how some people still want this to be like how is that, like, what are their reasoning for that? When they say, no,
well,
we want
like
it
I
to
said,
still be, like, what are their reasons?
You got to tune in next week because it can't
right.
be wrapped up into one sentence, you know what I mean? Or one or two sentences. It's a whole scenario. We got to show it to you, what these people are saying. And race is not a limiter. You got black people also giving pro-slavery arguments. There was one conservative talk show host, millions of people, he's a black person, and during the period when Kanye West was talking about the 13th Amendment, it should be changed because of it allowed slavery as a trap door, he says, when everybody else was talking about how Kanye West was crazy and saying slavery had been abolished, he said, I understand what Kanye says. I know what he's talking about, and he is right, but I believe that slavery is a great deterrent against crime. Like, what?
Right, yeah.
Like, he said, if you think you're going to be enslaved, you won't commit a crime.
Right, right.
But
that's just North Korea reasoning. Like, this is
this is supposed to be the United States. We're supposed to set the standard for liberty for the planet, and to be talking about how to handle human behavior and crime and criminality, and then to basically advocate for a North Korean solution is, yeah, that's pretty nuts.
It is absolutely nuts. So next week, that'll be our topic. We'll be sharing the pro-slavery arguments so other people can hear what these nutcases are saying. And they're dangerous nutcases because they have legislative influence and millions of listeners and things
millions
like that
of listeners.
Are following these arguments to keep slavery. Some of them are very upfront about, others are more subtle with theirs. You know, in Louisiana, their racism is right in your face. But in Oregon, it was kind of less. In New Jersey, it's a little bit less. In Ohio, they were like, what did they say about Oregon and Ohio? It's like, those lunatics over in
Ohio.
Yeah,
psychopaths
in Oregon want to get rid of slavery because they don't want child molesters to work in prison. Like, that's how they talk all the time. Everybody's a child molester.
Always to the extreme.
Yeah, it's always to the extreme. But it's not really even limited to just that area. As I said, as slavery abolitionists, we're very holistic with this. We see this happening in different sectors. It's a system that touches every aspect of U.S. life mm-hmm. like it always has. It's inseparable mm-hmm. from the other things. You can't have slavery without slave catchers, for instance, you know? And that's what we see happening every day. And speaking of those, there's issues going on in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, that should be of our attention as well. Where, like, in Chicago, they had a black site called the Brave Cave, where they would take young black men, this task force would take them in there, and women too, and brutalize them, abuse them, even sexually molest them, deny all of their rights and interrogation without attorneys, the whole nine yards. And there was a big expose when the police chief of the past 7 years finally got sick of it, what the council were doing behind the scenes in order to hamstring him. He had terminated a number of police who were involved with this, even the deputy chief who was under him was a part of it. He led this whole task force, secret task force with this Brave Cave. And he had been trying to prosecute them because they kept getting their jobs back, a number of them coming back to work. And it turned out that the city council was denying him funding for an attorney to prosecute. Like, they were doing it on purpose to give these cops a way back. But I'll let him tell the whole story and show you how, in every aspect, we see this slavery mentality occurring with the systemic racism. So this is the Baton Rouge Chief of Police, Murphy Paul, and his statements on corruption and the black site crackdown called Brave Cave. You're listening to Abolition Today, abolitiontoday.org, with Max Parthas and Yusuf Hassan. We're joined today by Ophelia Healing Justice and North New Hampshire State Representative Amanda Bolden. Just call her Amanda. We'll be right back after this.
Abolition. Abolition. Today.
This is Baton Rouge Chief of Police, Murphy Paul, above me. I want you to listen to what happened at the Baton Rouge Metro Council meeting when we were addressing the Brave Cave, where I told you some Baton Rouge police officers were taking some people into this warehouse, strip searching them illegally. The Baton Rouge Chief of Police has been dealing with it, and we, the citizens, want him to be the person to deal with it. White council members asked this man to resign this week. You hear some chat in the background, but I want you to listen to this video. Because to me, this is what we as black people should get from black leaders in law enforcement. He's fired 14 cops. He has had 8 cops resign in lieu of termination. And the reason that these people don't like what he said is because he exposed why some cops have gotten their job back, why some cops have been put back into positions after he tried to get rid of them, because they fired his damn lawyers. They won't even pay his damn lawyers. Watch this.
This is what I'm trying to say. Mr. Chambers, I apologize if it came off.
Mo.
Yes, sir. I want this matter resolved, and I want the place shut down, and I want everything. I know it's been shut down. I want it gone, and I want all of this resolved. But we can't accept the fact of where everything, the buck starts and stops.
So let's talk bucks. I've been quiet for 4 days. I haven't been here 7 years. I'm sorry, Mayor President, but I'm going to speak my heart on this one. So let's talk about processes. Let me count. Fourteen police officers were terminated. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 resigned under investigation. And then there's appeals. And you know what you do? You strip my funding. Are you going to pay the attorney all the money that I already owe them for the bad cops that the Civil Service Board, where we're going to be here tomorrow, and none of y'all going to be here. And y'all sitting here trying to deal off these people's emotions, and some of y'all the problem, Jen Rocker. You sit there, defund the police department's budget from a legal standpoint, and then come here because I don't have legal representation and I got to play lawyer to fight these bad actors. Let's talk facts. Let's talk facts. And then what you do? Then you go and you appoint people to the Civil Service Board that have direct ties to the union. There are 5 people on the Civil Service Board. What's wrong with good law-abiding citizens? You putting people on the Civil Service Board with direct ties to the union and wonder why they reverse the decisions that I make. I've been quiet, but I'm not going to be quiet no more. Where were you when they called my kids gangbangers? Where were you? You know about the pictures when they called my black boys gangbangers and I prayed for them. When the former chiefs of police sit down and share pictures of me and my girlfriend and I prayed for them. Where were you, Mocha, when they went to Texas, to the camp, and called me a nigga because I was trying to bring reform in this police department? Where were you then, speaking up for them? Don't sit here and play like you don't know about this group of bodies that tried to force the mayor to sit there and fire me for lies and say I only discipline white folks, which is a lie. Don't pretend like you don't know that. Don't pretend like you don't know that. Talk about my little black kids, and I prayed for y'all. I prayed for them. And you sit here like you different, like you not in cahoots. Because I'm going to tell you what they said. They got 6 of y'all in their pocket. Facts. 6 of y'all in their pocket. That's what the union said. The same union tomorrow, when we have a hearing right here before this body, where I said that the search and seizures were improper and illegal. How many of y'all going to be here tomorrow when the attorneys fight and say I should not have disciplined that office? I've been quiet for 5 and a half years, but after November the 8th, I'm not going to be quiet no more. I've been praying for y'all. You think I don't know about the backdoor meetings y'all have with these people, and you sit here like you some... Come on now.
Thank you, Chief. Got a couple questions for you.
My black boys, you know how it feels for a black man?
Chief.
To have little black kids that I have to have conversations with about law enforcement, and they're sharing pictures calling my kids gangbangers, the same people you have these backdoor meetings. Do you know how that feels?
Stop his time.
Do you know how it feels to have police officers telling other officers, tell me when you see the chief out there so we can come in case he's drinking, so they can pull me over? The same people y'all have these backdoor meetings with. Let's have these conversations today. And I pray for y'all. And even in my retirement, when you know I'm leaving and there's going to be accountability, you still doing what you do. Shame on you. When you go home and you think about your children, I love my black boys the same way you love theirs. Yours.
That is what I want from a black chief of police. Somebody who's willing to do the job, somebody who's willing to hold people accountable and tell the damn truth.
Abolition. Abolition. Today. Abolition. Today.
Abolition. Today. Wow. So you just heard Baton Rouge Chief of Police, Murphy Paul, his statements on corruption and the black site crackdown. That was really powerful, Ophelia. I'd like to hear your feedback on what you just heard.
Yeah, so I was just a little bit confused. So that was Murphy Paul, and he was speaking about how they were doing the black site where they were, you know, having people come in and, like, you know, raping people, beating them up and things like that. But who was he speaking to? Was he in, like, a
city
courtroom
council.
Speaking?
He was at the city council.
Baton Rouge City Council.
Okay, okay. Yeah, no, like, that's the kind of, you know, people that we want to see in, you know, elected officials and things like that, that we want to see take leadership instead of, like, you know, being quiet in certain places and around different faces. So that's the kind of leadership that I want to see, and I respect him for that. So kudos to Murphy Paul for that.
Amen. It pointed out the systemic racism that is happening, and also showed how the police unions, which include the prison guards, pretty much control the city council. Like you said, we got 60 out in our pockets. Amanda?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm reminded of the, I think Richie Torres was a candidate for Congress in
right.
New York State, and the police union was, like, actively coming after him, like, publicly on Twitter. No shame, no embarrassment. There was nothing about it that was behind closed doors. They were unabashed in their criticism of him, and I think they called him a lot of ugly things on social media. The willingness with some people in power to, like, the confidence that they're always going to be able to maintain their power, they don't even feel like they need to hide who they are, is pretty shocking.
And this is apparently one of the reasons why New Hampshire felt it necessary to enact a law that prohibits racial profiling in law enforcement and sentencing just this past March. This is something we see nationwide. And, you know, they were sitting there smug like they're participating in some democratic process when they know that behind closed doors they were doing the exact opposite. They were stacking the deck for the people who were there as part of the committee to oversee this. He had gotten rid of 20 policemen, and some of them were getting their jobs back. Why? Because the union controls the city council. You see anything on that?
Yeah, I mean, that's it. That's exactly it. You know, when they're in charge with, like, policing themselves, I mean, what do you think they're going to do? You know,
that's
just like when we're trying to abolish slavery in these states, and then they're saying to us, well, let's hear what the Department of Corrections has to say about this. How do they feel about it? Like, what do you expect them to say?
Excuse me, slavers, how do you feel about us ending slavery? You know?
That's funny.
But that's
so
what we have to do.
In New Hampshire, in New Hampshire, you know, it's small-town politics no matter where you go in the state, and everybody knows everybody. And, again, going back to, like, how – for economic reasons, like, most people don't come here for opportunity. They just are born here and they either stay or leave. There's a whole lot of people in politics that went to high school together, that went to middle school together, that, you know, so-and-so's grandmother babysat them, and now they're both in politics together. And we have in Manchester, New Hampshire, where I live, there's a candidate for mayor right now who's a Democrat. And when he was running for state senate, he answered a candidate survey saying he supported the legalization of cannabis. But once elected to the state senate, he never voted for it once. He voted against it every single time. And now he's running for mayor, which means he'll be in charge of the police department and everything that comes from that. And I've been at his fundraisers because of my position helping with the party. And I've seen the checks that the police union writes for him, and they're hefty in comparison to how much you would normally donate to a campaign of that size. And he's, you know, personal friends with the union members. And that's if there's any union that really needs a check, it's definitely police union. And so that's the thing, is there's so many people that maybe come from a more conspiratorial perspective, and they would say that such and such organization has a grip on some form of government or whatever, But when it comes to local politics, at least in New Hampshire, I can personally attest that quite literally the union, the heads of the police union are personal friends with the people making laws, making the city ordinances that directly relate to how, like, they directly control how police interact with people in the city limits and what are, you know, what sorts of things you're going to get in trouble for. Like, recently they passed an ordinance banning people from, if you're in a city park, you can't have more than one umbrella or a shopping cart, which is its own, and going back to Jim Crow laws, what? And the phrasing of the 13th Amendment, it's a direct attack on homelessness. They're criminalizing homelessness by saying you can't have more than one umbrella because they know they got to let you have one umbrella because they don't want their friends getting in trouble. But once you've reached two, then they're going to assume that you're not just protecting yourself from the rain, but you're trying to survive outdoors, and they want to criminalize that. So there's so many aspects of public policy that are framed exactly in the way of the 13th Amendment, where they don't want to say, they want to say it very quietly, the most important aspect of it. They don't want to say, we don't want to see homeless people in our city, we don't care how your problem is solved, just leave. So instead they say, you can't have more than one umbrella or a shopping cart. And that's coming directly from people. That person who's running for mayor is a city alderman, and he voted for that measure as an alderman to criminalize homelessness. And now he wants to directly run the police department. And it's so even though it sounds conspiratorial, it's very real. There's direct and personal relationships between the police union and the lawmakers.
Yes, it's very conspiratorial. And we've had that problem here in South Carolina as well as across the nation. They were here in South Carolina until we exposed this money-making effort that they were putting together to criminalize the homeless. They were going to create a court just for the homeless, hire judges and prosecutors just for the homeless, bailiffs and secretaries and on just for the homeless, and then have trials where they would decide to send them to jail or not. And this was at a time when they put those spikes on the benches that you have to pay for in order to sit on the bench, or the spikes, you know, and doing everything they can to get rid of the homeless population. Here we had like 1,400 homeless people or unhoused people, but we only had a facility that would hold about 100 or so. So, yeah, that's where they expand the system of slavery into different areas to get more bodies, including the jails, the immigration systems, the juvenile detention facilities, which are off the charts across the country. We had an interview with Dennis Febo, the lead organizer for the ASNN now, not too long ago, and he was explaining to us how in New Jersey to incarcerate a single teenager is $620,000. $620 a year for one child. I don't know how much it costs in New Hampshire, but I would suspect it's probably well over $200,000 a year.
It's 500 and what was it? 550,000, 580,000, some outrageous number.
588,000 to incarcerate a single teenager in New Hampshire is not a cost; it's an incentive. It's like a big-ass brass ring you could grab for the state or the county or the city for every single one of them that get put into these detention centers. Listen, we have about 10 minutes of time that we can where we can finish up here, and I want to make sure I give you both a chance to say any final comments and, of course, talk about, you know, the bills that you've got coming up now through the ASNN. But before that, I see we got a hand up. Would you be willing to take a call from your area code? Question or comment from the area code? Amanda, Ophelia, is that okay?
You're saying it's a 603 number?
Yes.
Oh. Yeah, that's fine.
All right. 4336, you're live on with Abolition Today. State your name and where you calling from, your question or comment.
Hi, my name is Giselle. And I'm calling from right now I'm in Fremont, but I stay in Manchester. And I wanted to comment on, I wanted to highlight part of this whole situation and system that gets overlooked a lot, and that's that, like, even when this bill passes, as far as it being implemented in the actual prison centers, the DOC following through and abiding by the statutes and the law and the bills that get passed, that's where the problem is because the laws and the bills can get passed. It's making sure that the DOC is making sure that they're following it, because
right.
For example, the Lawman decree has been in effect for has been in place. They have been obligated contractually for years, and still are not abiding by the Lawman decree. So, I'm not saying this to, you know, make it seem hard. I'm just saying so that we as a people can get proactive and actually bring awareness to that part of the problem.
You're absolutely right, Giselle. And that is why the ASNN is very thorough what we're doing. Step one is to make slavery illegal. Step two is to challenge the badges and incidents of slavery that are the practice itself, and then take those to court so that those things end. We're already working with lawyers in a number of states across the country that have abolished slavery, like Alabama and Colorado, who are bringing lawsuits or challenging executive orders or challenging civil rights issues. So we've got that covered as well. We understand.
Okay. Yes. But on that note, can I comment response to that?
Sure.
Okay. From my experience, I'm not going to say all, but from my experience, even the courts are biased. It's like we go to court, like, let's say it's, you know, an inmate, whatever the case, whoever's suing. If it's not an official, it's almost like the official's word is what it is. They make statements and they go under oath under the pains and penalties of perjury and lie like it's nothing. And it's just their word is taken over, you know, the rest of the people. So it's another challenge in the whole process that I just wanted to bring light to. Wish us luck. I'm with it too.
We will wish us luck. Yes, in challenging these badges and incidents, all we need to do is set precedents, and we can apply it across the whole country. And we've got an army of lawyers that are attempting to do that. We've got people even going to law school just to do that. So, yes,
right.
Certainly wish all those people luck on getting these things through. We only need to get through one or two.
Yes, absolutely. Prayer.
So thank you for
that's
calling.
That's praying, and I pray. Thank you.
We appreciate your questions and comments. I want to take this opportunity to give our guests a chance to say whatever they want to say to our audience. And make sure you push for some support on this upcoming bill. So let's start with Sister Ophelia.
No, I just wanted to say thank you, Griselli, for calling in. She's definitely with the movement.
Yes.
She has been very supportive thus far. And so I just wanted to say thank you for that. And I don't know if we have enough time for you to kind of explain, because she is very for, like, holding elected officials and, you know, cops accountable for, you know, the laws that they're trying to push on us and make sure they're held accountable when they don't abide by them. So when you say that the first step is to make slavery illegal, second step is to challenge the badges and incidents. I don't know if a lot of people know exactly what badges and incidents is. I don't know if you can kind of, you know, say a little quick definition of
yes.
what that is, Matt, so people know.
Slavery is a system, and the badges and incidents are the instances within that system. Acts of systemic racism, for instance, would be another. The ratio of arrests per 100,000 would be another. The fact that there's one in three. Young black men expect to go to the prisons is another. The forced labor is another. The abuse and the dehumanization, the human rights violation, all of that are badges and incidents of slavery. So that's what we mean by those. All the things that come with slavery, like he's talking about women being shackled as they're giving birth. Those are slave-like conditions, and they need to be challenged. And when people violate these new constitutional amendments, they have to be held accountable. And that's what we'll be doing.
which is step three. Yes,
right,
so step three
exactly.
will be holding them accountable. So what Vaseli
right.
was trying to say is, so when it comes to DOC, one step two, challenging the badges and incidents, you know,
mm-hmm.
is done. If DOC is not following these, you know, rules, then we're going to hold them accountable. We know
that's
we
right.
have ACLU. We're going to start suing them and holding them accountable like they should be. So that right there will hopefully that gives you the confidence to let you know that we will be holding these people held accountable. And yes, held accountable. So, you know, that's why we want everybody that's listening in right now. You know, me and Amanda, we are getting this on the ballot for, 2024. We would like everybody to support us as much as you can. I'm going to be doing a lot of town halls and abolition network meetings to join me. I would have Yusuf and Max, you know, put it on their page, on my page as well, to have you guys join us. I'll be teaching you guys a lot about this movement, what are next steps and things like that. So please join and support us. And let's, you know, let's abolish this slavery.
Amen. Thank you,
Amen
Amelia.
For that.
Sister Amanda?
Yeah.
I guess if anyone's listening, whoever finds themselves in D.C., one of my ancestors who was a slaveholder is memorialized in D.C. in the Congressional Cemetery. And if you'd ever like to go spit on it, you'd just get there before me because I've been meaning to. But every time I'm in D.C., I'm a little late. Thomas Holden had among the humans he owned and I assume abused, was an eight-month-old baby, according to the slave schedule that I pulled up from 1850. And, he's the only person to have died in the congressional chamber. He died mid-speech. He was in trouble for something, I guess, and was defending himself, trying to. And then he just dropped dead right there. So, you know, karma and all that. But I think that's my only... closer. I welcome anyone who'd be interested to thumbs down at my family history. It's a funny thing about having ancestors who are accomplished in their lives, but your family will tell you all the good things that they did and leave it to you to figure out the bad things, which has been, you know, what
right.
I've been working on for a few years now.
I want to say thank you to you both. It's been a pleasure to have you here with us on Abolition Today. It's just been like a conversation, like we said in the beginning, you know what I mean? You kind of forget that you were on air, but this is the conversation that people need to hear where they understand more because this is something that most people don't know even exists. So thank you so much for joining us. Of course, we're going to be speaking more in the ASNN meetings, and we'll have you back on air again. Before we finish off tonight, and I pass it to Yusuf for... thanking our sponsors and guests, I did want to make a note that there has been some tragedies happening in the Middle East, right? Now, I got nothing to say at this point about what's happening in the Middle East, nothing I want to tell random people at least, but I am fairly certain a lot of oppressed groups and people are watching and studying how this turns out and measuring the price being paid, the sacrifices being made. From a perspective mm-hmm. on the outside, I know that justice delayed is justice denied. What will an oppressed people do when all else has been tried? As an observer, I'm keenly reminded of the confessions of Nat Turner. With that being said, next week, check us out as we bring in the slavers' opinions and give the pro-slavery arguments some shine. Let you hear them yourself. And the week after that is our final episode. Abolition Today season 4. So we ask that you join us. We're going to bring on some special guests and go out with a bang. And then we'll be back January first week for season 5 of Abolition Today. Yusuf?
Wow.
Yeah, and for what Max just said, it probably was a poem. We're going to have to listen to it later and see if he was actually giving us a poem. But thank you, Ophelia. Thank you, Amanda. Thank you, Wu, for calling in. We also want to thank our sponsors and partners, Jailhouse Lawyers Speak, the I Am We Ubuntu Prison Advocacy Network, Sama Urge as Quakers Uplifting Racial Justice, the Paul Cuffey Abolitionist Center, Remember to subscribe to our YouTube channel. That's youtube.com/abolitiontoday. And our Facebook page also is Abolition Today. Follow us on Twitter at AbolitionToday1. And also follow the Abolish Slavery National Network at Abolition Nation on all platforms. Tonight's Bridging the Gap is going to be something really special. They're all always special. But this week it comes from a group called African American History is American History. This is going to be episode 52 entitled Vermont, First of the 13 Colonies to Abolish Slavery, followed by We Are Messengers. Yes, we are. We are messengers. The devil is a liar. So we'll be back live next Sunday, God willing, Sunday, October 15th, with another masterclass on slavery, abolition. And as Max just mentioned, make sure you tune in October 22nd for our season finale. So you don't want to miss any of those. If you're a new listener, you can always go to abolitiontoday.org, catch all of our archives. We're in season 4. This is episode 28. We're also on all major streaming platforms, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, all of them. So we welcome you, and we are thankful for you tuning in. So until next week, think about abolition today. Peace and blessings be upon you all.
Peace.
Abolition. Abolition. Today.
Vermont has long been known for its independence. Before it became our 14th state, the people of Vermont were not all that excited about joining this new United States. But they also had no desire to remain a part of the British Crown. Vermonters loved being independent and made that clear to the other colonies, especially when it came to slavery. On July 2nd, 1777, responding to the numerous calls from Quaker-led abolitionists to end slavery, not just in New England, but throughout the 13 colonies, Vermont became the first colony to ban it outright. Not only did Vermont's legislature agree to abolish slavery entirely, it also moved to provide full voting rights for African-American males. Earlier in 1774, New England area colonies, Rhode Island and Connecticut, had outlawed overseas slave importation, but still allowed inter-colony slave trade. On November 25, 1858, Vermont ratified an even stronger anti-slavery law into its constitution. The Freedom Act of 1858 declared that any slave brought into Vermont was free. However, this did little to end the disdain and cruelty with which Black Americans were treated in the North. Each state had their own legal restrictions in place, making it difficult to damn near impossible for free Blacks to find good work, own property, or even remain in the state. Now, talk about a paradox. Rhode Island, while legally ending slave importation from overseas, continued to have the highest number of slave auctions in the New England states. Additionally, Rhode Island's laws governing the treatment of African Americans, free or slave, were constantly being revised and updated and were among the harshest in the colonies. If free Blacks associated with slaves, both could be whipped. Anyone giving an African American a cup of hard cider was leveled with a heavy fine, whipped, or both. Chapter 1 of the Constitution, titled A Declaration of the Rights of the Inhabitants of the State of Vermont, said, quote,
"No male person born in this country or brought from overseas ought to be holden by law to serve any person as a servant, slave, or apprentice after he arrives to the age of 21 years, nor female in the like manner, after she arrives to the age of 18 years, unless they are bound by their own consent, after they arrive to such age or bound by law for the payment of debts, damages, fines, costs, or the like, or the like."
Now, just to be clear, Vermont's July 1777 declaration to abolish slavery wasn't entirely an act of selfless compassion. While Vermont did
said in independent tone from the 13 colonies, the declaration's wording was just vague enough to let Vermont's already established slavery practices continue.
If we'd known you all were going to be this much trouble, we would have picked our own fucking cotton.
Abolition. Abolition.
I'm exhausted. Last night I couldn't sleep, but when I did, I could hear bombs in my dreams. Nightmare situation. How could they be so evil? Making murders out of children and innocent people. We expect the bombs, not knowing where next. Huddle in the corner of my room, trying to protect my little brother. The building shakes like it's possessed, but nothing stronger than the will of the oppressed. I bomb back with my lyrics and rhymes, living the times, trying to break the Palestinian minds. What's hiding in the clouds hanging over my head? My dad risks his life outside to buy bread. The fourth war in my 12th year. At this stage I'm numb, though I haven't felt scared. There's nothing I can do in this case to stay safe. I'm brave, even though this house could be in my grave. I want freedom for the population. 2 million prisoners living in this location. Shouting at the wall, but nothing is ever changing. That's life under an occupation. I want freedom for the population.
born, fighting with grief. White sheets cover bodies that lie on the streets. Buildings turn to ash, but my mind is made of steel. So it doesn't take much for me to heal. Won't lose the will to live or lose our minds. My auntie lost her home, so she lost her life. But she's still alive, but traumatized by the bombs that flew in and dropped that night. My sister couldn't sleep, tried to stop her cries. I said it was fireworks, I was telling her lies. Where's the compassion? This is heartless. It's like they want us all living in darkness. Cutting off water and electricity for hours. They're knocking towers, but that's not knocking the power that I have in my pen. When I'm writing, I'm unstoppable. The microphone is the only escape possible, cause that's the way that I can speak my mind. I wonder how does the fighter pilot sleep at night, knowing he can turn the city upside down all of a sudden. Slaughtering families with the push of a button. I want freedom for the population. 2 million prisoners living in this location. Shouting at the wall, but nothing is ever changing. Death life under an occupation. I want freedom for the population. 2 million prisoners living in this location. Shouting at the wall, but nothing is ever changing. Death life under an occupation.
Abolition. 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 Abolition.